Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On September 8th, 2004, CBS News 60 Minutes broadcast an explosive segment raising questions about then-President George W. Bush's National Guard service record. The piece was anchored by Dan Rather and produced by veteran CBS News producer Mary Mapes. In the first half of the segment, Dan Rather interviewed Ben Barnes, former Lieutenant Governor of Texas and Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives. While in those roles, Barnes says, quote, "It was important to make friends. I recommended a lot of people for the National Guard during the Vietnam era," end quote. Well, George W. Bush was one of those people, and that was in 1968. Serving in the National Guard allowed him to avoid serving in Vietnam. The following 60-minute segment not only claimed that George W. Bush may have skirted serving in Vietnam, but questioned the consistency of the time he served. That charge was based on documents obtained from Bush's former squadron commander, the late Colonel Jerry Killian. He passed away in 1984. The memo suggested gaps in George W. Bush's service. In one of the memos, Killian writes that a retired Texas American National Guard general was putting pressure on him to sugarcoat Bush's officer evaluation. In less than 24 hours after that 60 Minutes piece aired, right-wing bloggers began questioning the documents, and media coverage ignored the allegations that Bush went AWOL and instead focused on the authenticity of the Killian documents. Shortly thereafter, Dan Rather stepped down as CBS News anchor, and Mary Mapes lost her job and reputation. A new film, Truth, revisits the 60 Minutes segment and the controversy that ensued. The film is based on Mary Mapes' memoir, Truth and Duty: The Press, the President, and the Privilege of Power. And joining us to talk about what happens when big media collides with the powers that be is James Vanderbilt, director of Truth. Truth is James' directorial debut, and he joins us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. I should say that we also invited Dan Rather and Mary Mapes. They were not available, but we do have clips from Dan Rather to play throughout the show. We also invited CBS, but they are not available. Instead, they sent us their spokesperson statement. It's from Gil Schwartz, who says CBS believes that the film tries to turn gross errors of journalism and judgment into acts of heroism. And CBS has refused to air ads about Truth in its nighttime shows. First, James, were you surprised when you found out that CBS refused to air ads about Truth?
I was, yes. You know, I wasn't surprised that they had a negative reaction to the film. You know, it's sort of, you know, if you make a movie like this, you know, you don't think they're going to, you know, call you up and say, first of all, thank you. We're really happy that you brought this back up. But I was taken aback by the fact that they didn't want to air ads.
So let's talk about when you first decided to take on this major, major product. I understand that you were reading Vanity Fair magazine and you read an excerpt of Mary Mapes' memoir, the memoir about what happened, Truth and Duty. Talk about what struck you about that and why you decided to take on this project after reading that excerpt.
Well, I mean, I the way I sort of came to it was through Mary Mapes' book. I mean, I didn't watch the original 60 Minutes two-piece that aired on Wednesday night in September, but I certainly heard about it on Thursday. You know, it was everywhere. And, you know, the firestorm that kind of exploded out of it, you sort of couldn't get away from. And it was very, very big, very, very quickly. And I sort of experienced it like pretty much everyone did, as sort of a citizen sort of looking on. But I didn't start thinking about it as a film until I read Mary's book. And what struck me, the first thing that struck me about Mary's book was how much I didn't know about a subject I thought I knew a bunch about. And I'd always been fascinated with journalism. I always, you know, for me, journalism is a little bit the road not taken. You know, if I hadn't gone into, you know, my silly business, I really, really was interested in journalism because it's all, you know, it's all storytelling. It's all the same form of that. And so I loved the idea of making a film that would take you behind the curtain of how broadcast journalism was done back then, how, you know, how stories like this are put together, and then, of course, you know, how this particular story fell apart. And also I fell in love with Mary as a character, and I ended up, you know, getting to know her quite well through the process. And she just struck me as such an interesting, intelligent, smart, funny, passionate person and somebody who just would make an amazing character to see in a feature film. So for all of those sorts of reasons, when I read the book, I started thinking about maybe there's a movie here.
Now, you visited Mary in Dallas, Texas, and you talked to her about making this film. She's played by Cate Blanchett in the film. And Mary Mapes, I learned a lot about her in your film, too, and then went on to read more about her. She won a Peabody Award for her 60-minute segment that broke the Abu Ghraib story of torture in Iraq.
She did, yeah. It was the story she did right before the Bush Guard story. Was Abu Ghraib. She broke Abu Ghraib, which is, you know, an amazing piece of journalism, especially if you go back and look at it, too. You know, it was incredible. And it was incredibly difficult to run, you know, at that time, too, because it was about, you know, our troops, you know, abusing prisoners in Iraq. So it was a very controversial story. But, you know, she had this incredible career, this 15-year career at CBS. She actually says, you know, I had 15 great years at CBS and 5 bad months. But so she was really at the top of her game when this happened. And I loved the idea, too, of sort of going behind the curtain and seeing that it's really the producers, you know, who are putting the stories together. And, you know, sort of Dan Rather, who's wonderful, but is out front. But, you know, Dan is not the one who's knocking on all the doors and making all the phone calls to put this together. It's the producer. It's the person you don't see who, you know, puts the story together from soup to nuts.
Right. And on her team was Lieutenant Colonel Roger Charles. He was a military consultant who worked with Mapes on the Abu Ghraib story. Also, Lucy Scott, a journalism professor from Dallas, and Mike Smith, a Texas-based freelancer who worked with Mapes. And so Mary Mapes got together with Josh Howard, executive producer of 60 Minutes, and basically said, I've got this amazing story, and I think we should pursue it.
Yeah, she had done some work on it back in 2000. You know, Mary, you know, one of the reasons that, and sometimes she's portrayed as somebody who has this, you know, this axe to grind about the Bush family, which is couldn't be farther from the truth. The reason she was on it is because she worked in Dallas and she worked at the Dallas Bureau. So she had been around for the gubernatorial run and for the first presidential election. And there had always been rumors about this, especially in Texas politics. And so she had done some work on this story in 2000. And then her mother had passed away, which had sort of taken her out of, you know, as it would for anybody, you know, taken her out of her work. And in 2004, they got some interesting tips about it that kind of put them back onto the story. And it was a very different time to be on the story because it was now a presidential re-election. And, you know, 2000 was peacetime. 2004, you know, we had boots on the ground in two different theaters of war. So the president's military service took on a very different shade of importance at that point.
Now, this information was actually reported before Mary Mapes was working on this story. There's a piece in Salon by Paul Rosenberg that's very extensive that looks at President Bush's military service. And he points to a Boston Globe story that ran on May 23rd, 2000 by reporter Walter Robinson. And he found a one-year gap in Bush's guard duty, saying that 22 months after finishing his training and with 2 years left on his six-year commitment, Bush gave up flying for good. Paul writes, beyond a momentary flurry, there wasn't much other corporate media interest in that cycle, though Martin Helt published a detailed analysis of Bush's guard records at the Online Journal in September 2000. Fast forward to the morning of the 60 Minutes report, and Robinson wrote another story, Bush fell short on duty at guard, with record show pledges unmet as the subhead. And so this points out that the media, some in the media, were reporting on this in 2000, but it just didn't get much traction.
No, it didn't. And it was, you know, it was interesting. There was and it's something we deal with in the film, is a lot of different people were sort of onto the story. The 60 Minutes 2-piece, the big break for them really was getting Ben Barnes, the former lieutenant governor, to go on the record about it and to sort of raise his hand and say, I'm the guy who got George W. Bush into the National Guard. That was sort of the big thing about it. And then in addition to that, they got a hold of these memos, which they vetted and believed to be real, that filled in different parts of George W. Bush's Texas Air National Guard file. The file itself is there are a lot of holes in it. There's a lot of papers missing. There's a lot of there's a lot of stuff that's just not there. And so these documents seem to slot in perfectly and fill in those gaps.
And so we'll talk about those documents, but first, just to take people back in time. So Ben Barnes is a former lieutenant governor of Texas and speaker of the Texas House. And he says it was important to make friends. I recommended a lot of people for the National Guard during the Vietnam era, and George W. Bush was one of those people. And 60 Minutes actually got audio of him talking about this at a fundraiser, right? So before they found that audio, he didn't want to talk to them.
No, he didn't want to talk to them. He didn't want to talk to anybody. And one of the things I think is fascinating about the film is, and why I was really interested in telling this story, is it's a moment in media where technology and the internet starts to overtake kind of mainstream media. And people didn't think back in 2004 about the idea that if you spoke at a political fundraiser, there could be somebody with a camera phone.
Right.
You know, it was sort of so everything was sort of a little bit off the record in back rooms. And, you know, we're going to. And so he told the story at the fundraiser about how he got the president into the National Guard. He had already told Mary Mapes and other reporters that he wasn't going to talk about it on the record. And yet he ends up on the internet in a video clip saying it. And the cat is, you know, for all intents and purposes, out of the bag at that point. And so that's one of the things that Mary and her team, you know, sort of said to him, listen, it's out there. You know, there's a video of you saying it. So, you know, I think it's time to tell the truth about it.
Okay, so Ben Barnes tells the truth. He got George W. Bush into the National Guard in 1968. He signed on for a 6-year commitment. And records show that he does well until the spring of 1972 when he's suspended for missing a routine physical. And so that segment, nobody had a problem with. It was the following segment, like you said. It not only claimed that Bush skirted serving in Vietnam, but questioned the consistency of the time that he served. And so talk a little bit about what went on behind the scenes with Mary Mapes trying to get her hands on the documents that purported to show that Bush went AWOL.
Well, it's interesting, and it becomes, and I just want to be sort of clear about it. The idea that George W. Bush are going AWOL had been, as you pointed out, had been around for much longer than just in the summer and fall of 2004. There was stuff in Bush's file which show no points registered on his time when his time in the Guard, which basically means he didn't show up for things for a long period of time. The documents that Mary got a hold of purported to show that somebody was trying to cover that up. So that Jerry Killian, who was George W. Bush's former commander, had been getting pressure from higher-ups to cover up the fact that Bush wasn't showing up when he was supposed to. And they believed this was proof that he was AWOL, in addition to what was already in his file, in addition to the fact that there were a lot missing from his file.
And in the film, Mary Mapes, played by Cate Blanchett, and her team are trying so hard to get someone to go on camera and talk about these documents and talk about whether or not Bush went AWOL. And person after person after person had the same exact line. It was something along the lines of, you know, I'm not available, that didn't happen. And so is that factual? Is that what Mary Mapes reported in her memoir?
It is. It is absolutely what she reported in her memoir. And I spoke to a bunch of other people who worked with her on the team, and this was that they would always sort of run into, which is understandable. I mean, you know, people didn't want to sort of dredge things up. And one of the things that, we, you know, we really try and portray in the film is what goes into putting a story like this together and the roads, you know, the roadblocks you kind of run into. And a lot of people didn't want to speak ill or positively of a sitting president at that time in the middle of presidential election.
And one man in the film says that when he was thinking about handing off these documents, he got run off the road, and so he was afraid. Did that also actually happen?
Well, that's what Bill Burkett, who is the man who gave Mary the documents, purported to have happened.
Okay.
And that's, again, not something that they were able to source. That's not something that they dug into.
Right.
But that was he and his wife claimed that one night they were run off the road.
I'm speaking with James Vanderbilt. He is the director of the new film Truth, which opens in the Bay Area tomorrow. Truth examines the 2004 60-minute story that raises questions about George W. Bush's military service in the National Guard. The piece ran just a couple months before the presidential election, and immediately after Dan Rather and his producer Mary Mapes broke the story, it was heavily, heavily attacked. And this is right in the beginning of the internet. I mean, most people didn't really know much about it, but there were a lot of bloggers out there, and they went after it. They talked about the font. It couldn't have happened in the 70s. They just slammed it. And so most media coverage focused on the authenticity of the documents, not the allegations of the piece that George W. Bush went AWOL. So what are your thoughts on this? If you remember that story, what do you remember about it? And what questions do you have about this? I mean, some of the biggest questions, what caused the blowback? What does this mean for journalism? And also, what are your thoughts about what happens when big media collides with the powers that be? What actually happens to the truth? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We invited Dan Rather and Mary Mapes. They were not available, although I do have a couple clips from Dan Rather to play. We also invited CBS, and they pointed us to their statement from spokesman Gil Schwartz. He says that the film tries to turn gross errors of journalism and judgment into acts of heroism. CBS has refused to air ads about Truth, but Truth ads are airing on the other networks, and they're all doing interviews about this film. And now I would like to welcome Glenn Smith to the show. Glenn has spent 30 years in journalism and politics, and in 2004, he authored a book called The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy. He wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called Truth, the Movie, When Truth and Power Collide. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Nice to have you. So you've spent many years writing about this. You've seen the film. What did you think of it?
Well, you know, first thing I want to say, I don't want to get lost in the old controversy, the artistry with which this film was made. And one, I do a lot of work on melodramatic storytelling in politics. And I think one of the great things about this movie is it avoids the melodramatic traps. It tells a very subtle story about it in a very important moment in American journalistic history, and I don't want the quality of the film to get lost in the controversy about the former president. But that controversy is sure there, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, well, and, you know, it's so interesting, Glenn, because it's bringing us back in time. And I was talking with James about the 2000 piece that ran in the Boston Globe by Walter Robinson. He reported that he found a one-year gap in Bush's guard duty in September 2000. This piece came out. Fast forward to the morning of the 60 Minutes report, and Robinson from the Boston Globe wrote another story, Bush Fell Short on Duty at Guard, with records showing pledges unmet. But as he wrote, the corporate media didn't really explore this. Why is that?
Well, that was a remarkable moment. You know, we found, and I had with a lot of different national allied groups put together a advertising campaign during that presidential election that pointed out that there was the Bush's military record was spotty at best, and there was no proof he'd actually completed it. And if you remember at the time, you know, Gary Trudeau, the Doonesbury author, MoveOn.org, at my request, offered $50,000 if somebody could step forward and with new proof that Bush had actually showed up at the base in Alabama. Nobody did. Trudeau had offered $10,000. Nobody claimed it. The Bush White House publicly said, we're going to find people that can confirm he showed up. They never did, and had to admit they never did. They found one fellow who went public, but he had his date so long they had to pull him back out of the public eye. There never was any doubt among Texas journalists from the moment Bush, from 1994 on, there was never any doubt that his military service was squirrely and that he probably hadn't completed it, but nobody had certain proof of that. All the proof was negative. Nobody could find out that he'd showed up at that base in Alabama.
So, James, let's talk a little bit about the documents that Bill Burkett handed to Mary Mapes. He was very hesitant to do this. How did she get him to hand over those documents?
Well, I mean, I think he was, you know, and she basically, you know, talked him into it. She, you know, he had wanted, you know, he wanted assurances from her. He wanted a, sort of a lot, and he didn't sort of know where to float it, and she sort of sold him on it, you know, as any good journalist would have said, this is, you know, talk to me. This is the right outlet to get your information out there. We're 60 Minutes. You know, we're the gold standard of television. You know, we're we feel that, you know, this is, you know, the best way to get your story out there.
And so the documents became known as the Killian documents. They appear to be signed by Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Killian, who passed away in 1984, commanding officer of the 111th Fighter Intercept Squadron during George W. Bush's time there. And the documents seem to corroborate the story that Bush ceased fulfilling his Texas Air National Guard duties. What did the documents say exactly?
They said in no uncertain terms that Killian, and their memos to file, which basically means memos that are written to himself and inserted into the file to sort of, one of them is actually titled CYA, which means cover your...
Mm-hmm. ASS,
and,
right.
And they basically said, yes, exactly. And they basically said that Killian was receiving pressure from higher-ups to sugarcoat the fact that George W. Bush had not shown up. For drills.
And so these documents are copies, and four independent document examiners were asked to analyze these memos for authenticity. And so what did they find?
Well, the way you sort of, if you're going to use copies, the only thing you can, there are sort of two routes you can do it. Since you can't analyze the paper, you can't analyze the ink, you can't carbon date anything, you have to analyze the content and compare that with how memos of the time are written, the vernacular of the guard at the time, the attitudes of the people who are involved. And then since they have signatures, there was handwriting analysis to Jerry Killian's signatures. So they attacked it from both sides. And obviously, all of the document examiners said the best version of this would be if we had originals to deal with, but since we don't, and we're analyzing on all of these bases, they, you know, some of them said, listen, it would be great to have more information, but based on what we have, we feel these are true documents.
And Glenn, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, it was kind of shocking to learn that the reason why 60 Minutes had to go to air this piece so quickly and not have more time for due diligence is because there was a piece about Dr. Phil that was airing. I mean, it's just kind of amazing. It says so much about journalism that they weren't able to give them a couple more weeks to try to figure out if these documents were actually authentic. I mean, down to the last minute they were cutting this piece. That was kind of shocking to learn about.
That kind of messiness is often behind the scenes in journalism, I'm sorry to say, but also needs to be noted, and I wrote about this at Huffington Post, and it's actually been in print, Texas Monthly, in 2012 and elsewhere, that one of the lawyers for the committee CBS put together in the aftermath of the story, one of those lawyers has actually confessed that they have found typewriters with that font size and with the proportional spacing.
Really?
And they've never refuted that since the lawyer confessed it publicly. In the sort of like folkloric way of telling these stories publicly, of course, and you can see it all over the right-wing blogs, especially today, they're just still saying those documents are lies because of the font and the proportional spacing, which has now been proven to have existed at the time. It's not grounds on which to reject these documents. Doesn't prove they're real, but it's not grounds to reject them as false.
I think also it's important to note, you know, one of the things we do in the film, which was really important to me, is the film is not made to convince you one way or the other if the documents are real. You know, the film doesn't have a political agenda built around that. What we really try and do is we try and give you all of the information. We show you what Mary and Dan and all of the reporters were dealing with at the time. We take you through the pressure cooker of putting a story together like this, which, as Glenn says, by the way, is more, you know, is more the rule than the exception in terms of how stuff like this gets put together, which I was sort of fascinated by. We show you all of the ways the documents were attacked.
And James, hold that thought.
You have that information.
We're going to take a quick break. We're talking about a new film called Truth. It examines the 2004 60 Minutes story that raised questions about George W. Bush's service in the National Guard. And we'll be back after this. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable, and we'll be talking about the Canadian elections, voters in Canada, and did Prime Minister Stephen Harper and his Conservative Party's nearly 10-year rule by handing the Liberal Party and its leader Justin Trudeau with a majority in the Parliament. We will also talk about the new top-secret NSA documents detailing the U.S. drone program, which were recently leaked to The Intercept. That's tomorrow, and if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're talking about a new film that opens in the Bay Area tomorrow. It's called Truth, and it examines the 2004 60-minute story that raised questions about George W. Bush's service in the National Guard. It ran just a couple months before the election, and immediately after Dan Rather and his producer Mary Mapes broke the story, it was heavily attacked, and most of the coverage, from the right-wing blogs to the national media, focused on the authenticity of the documents rather than the allegations that Bush went AWOL. So we're going to take your calls in just a minute. We're joined today by James Vanderbilt. He is director of Truth. Again, it opens tomorrow. We did invite CBS. They gave us their statement by spokesman Gil Schwartz, who said the film tries to turn gross errors of journalism and judgment into acts of heroism, and CBS has refused to run ads about Truth. We also invited Dan Rather and Mary Mapes. They were not able to join us, but we do have some clips from Dan Rather. We also are going to play a clip from Marion Carr Knox, who was Colonel Jerry Killian's secretary, and she will give her take about the documents. And we are also joined by Glenn Smith, longtime reporter who's also the author of The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy. And it takes a look at the Bush administration's manipulation of the media. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Dan in Carmel. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Very much. First question, can I ask a question? Glenn, I'm from Houston, and I'm just a couple of years older than George Bush. And when I went down to the Texas Air National Guard to try and get in during Vietnam, I was told there was a 5-year waiting list, and he got in, bam. So, number one, how could that happen?
Well, I think as former Lieutenant Governor Ben Barnes has said, and other officials at the time have confirmed, it was not unusual for the sons of important people, especially those in politics and government, to be jumped over that list. Now, the size of that list has often been disputed. What seems to be clear in this case is that there was no real pilot opening for Bush, as I think it's even pointed out in the movie, actually, that a lot of returning pilots from the war were going into the Guard, and they had no need for new pilots. But it's a confirmed fact that if you are a person of privilege, you could get your son into the Guard and avoid Vietnam. I don't, that's not much in dispute, and that's how it happened.
Yeah, but he has said many times, Bush has said many times, that he had no help in doing that.
Well, I mean, he did. And they've never really even disputed that. They just dodged the question, and I think it's now been confirmed. It's not just him. There were several other sons of politicians here and elsewhere that were found one route or another to avoid actually going to Vietnam.
Are you in Houston?
Austin now. I was born in Houston.
Oh, okay. Dan Rather used to hang out with the sports writer for the Houston Chronicle, who was my next-door neighbor, Morris Frank. Does that name ring a bell with you?
Of course. Grew up as a young person reading Morris Frank.
Well, and Dan Rather got the Morris Frank Library in Houston named for him, but I live in Carmel now. I'm so glad to be out of Texas.
Well, Well, Dan, thank you for calling. And I hope you can go to our website, yourcallradio.org, because we have a bunch of clips there. And again, Ben Barnes did not initially want to talk to Mary Mapes about the 60 Minutes piece. But when she found a clip of him talking at a fundraiser about getting young men into the National Guard, at that point, he really had no choice but to talk to her. And he said, "It was important to make friends. I recommended a lot of people for the National Guard during the Vietnam era." So I hope you can check out those clips. And thank you for calling in, Dan. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, morning. You know, I remembering that the Bush family is invested in a thing called the Carlyle Group, and the Carlyle Group's prospectus, if you go online and look it up, they look for companies that are in distress, and then they snap them up. So I'm wondering if when CBS was faced with this problem, if their share price fell and the Carlyle Group was able to invest in a kind of a strong-arm way in CBS and force the resignation of their top people.
James, do you know anything about that?
I don't specifically know in terms of whether the Carlyle Group had any dealings with CBS. I know that Dan did file a lawsuit against CBS after he left for breach of contract. Primarily he wanted to do that in order to sort of find out what had happened behind the scenes. I know there were a lot of different theories about the Bush family money and different investors. And one of the things we show in the film actually is Mary getting a tip about James Math and Bin Laden money, and then it's knocked down. So one of the things that was very important for them as reporters to do was to follow up on those things. But when they didn't pan out, they didn't, you know, sort of try and push it through. They didn't. They said, look, we can't confirm this, so we're not going to run this on the air.
Hmm. Well, and also CBS hired an independent investigation. They questioned Dan Rather, Mary Mapes, the reporters that worked on the team. They found no evidence of political bias in the reporting of the Guard story. Mary Mapes was fired. The rest were asked to leave. And James mentioned the lawsuit that Dan Rather filed for breach of contract, alleging that he was sidelined to appease the White House, and the suit was dismissed by a New York State appeals court. Let's play a clip. Dan Rather was on the Today Show on October 14th, and Matt Lauer asked him, because he saw the film, obviously he was involved with it, what would you do differently today? And here's Dan Rather.
I'd do a lot of things differently. What I wouldn't do differently is back off the story. The story was true. Because it was true, undeniable facts about how President Bush got into the Air National Guard to avoid service in Vietnam, and the fact that then after getting in, he disappeared. Those were facts, and that was true. Because it was true, those who wanted to discredit the story had to attack the process by which we got to the truth. And they successfully attacked us on that. So among the things I would do is, number one, I would realize that we had to have a much better defense in the blogosphere. Number two, quite frankly, CBS News, in a break with tradition, did not back its reporting. And that was a surprise and disappointment to me. But I have a lot of responsibilities in this myself.
Yeah, and as someone who had such a storied career up to that moment, what was it like for you to live in the eye of that storm where you were being so severely questioned?
Well, it wasn't pleasant. Let's say this was the darkest period of my professional career. I'd much rather a movie be made about my coverage of civil rights or Watergate or Vietnam War. But life's not like that, and it was a dark period. And when one was in the vortex of this, you have the sense that the world is spinning and sort of spinning out of control, and nothing you can do can pull you out of that. So what I try to do is recognize that, yes, we had made some mistakes in the process of developing the story, and as a consequence had left herself vulnerable. And the story became the mistakes we made in getting to the truth, not to the truth.
You mentioned a second ago changes in the...
And that is Dan Rather on the Today Show on October 14th. James Vanderbilt is director of the film Truth, and Glenn Smith has been a reporter for 30 years in Texas. He's the author of The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy. So James, Dan Rather to this day says this story was true.
Well, I mean, I think that what Dan is saying is that he believes that George W. Bush got preferential treatment to get into the National Guard, and that's the story they were covering, and he feels that was accurate.
And Glenn, what are your thoughts? We found a couple other clips of Dan Rather talking, and he said he doesn't want this to be about him or about the past. He really wants this to start a conversation about investigative reporting, about reporters asking tough questions, speaking truth to power, and really exposing information that matters.
Well, that's why I found it so fascinating to compare this film and the story it tells with All the President's Men and the story that book and film tells. I think it'd be great to take those films together into journalism classes across America, because if everyone will recall, Woodward and Bernstein also made a questionable step in saying that Haldeman had been named at the grand jury and is controlling a certain slush fund. In fact, he hadn't been named at that particular grand jury, but it turned out he did control that slush fund. That story was true. They got one element wrong. They were backed up by the leadership at the Washington Post at the time in a way far different than CBS treated Dan and Mary. Regardless, it's an unbelievable sort of productive for journalists, for wannabe journalists, for future journalists, for young people, to explore the questions raised by those two episodes in American history and the films about those episodes.
And Glenn,
one of the things
James.
Oh, sorry, I just wanted to say one of the things that because Robert Redford plays Dan Rather in our film, and one of the things that he and I spoke a lot about was the mirroring of the two films and the fact that, you know, All the President's Men is about two reporters doing a story on a sitting president, and our film is about two reporters doing a story on a sitting president. They both have very different outcomes, and why that is, I think, is a very interesting question.
James Vanderbilt is director of the new film Truth, which opens tomorrow. It examines the 2004 60 Minutes story that raised questions about George W. Bush's military service in the National Guard. And we're also joined by Glenn Smith. He's been a reporter for 30 years in Texas. He's the author of The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go next to Gar in Berkeley. Hi, Gar. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. I'm curious about part of the narrative here. The idea is that if the documents were a hoax, then there's no story. But that leads to an even bigger question and the bigger story. If they were a hoax, that means we shouldn't be ignoring the story. We should be asking, who's behind the hoax? Who could have the sophistication to create those faked documents? And who could have the sophistication to include minor elements that could be used by critics to claim that the documents were false, the kerning questions, the fonts, etc. Within hours, as the film points out, within hours of the broadcast, right-wing bloggers were attacking the documents' credibility using very refined points about superscripts and typesetting and proportional spacing. Who are these bloggers? It kind of looks as though they were ready to pounce. They had more information about those documents than the four document analysts that CBS had working on authenticating them. It can look to some people as though it might have been an intelligence trap. This was at the same time that John Kerry was being subjected to Swift voting attacks.
Right.
Who could put together a hoax like that, create those documents? Bear in mind that George W. Bush's father, was not only the President of the United States, but a former head of the Central Intelligence Agency. Has anyone explored the nature of the hoax explanation to the documentation?
James, has anyone looked at that? Who are these people who were so quick to start raising questions about the documents, which then became the focus of almost all of the attention?
Well, I will say that it wasn't even within hours. It was the episode was still airing when the first stuff popped up online that the documents might be fake. So it was almost instantaneous, which is really amazing. The speed with which this happened, and the speed that Mary and Dan and CBS were caught with off guard, which is the speed of media as it. You know, we're sort of now used to that being the speed of media as it works today. A friend of mine calls it the 24-second news cycle. But there are a lot of theories about where the documents came from and whether they were planted or not. We don't go into it in the film. One of the reasons we don't is because we can't confirm it. We can't There's no way to sort of say one way or the other if that's true or not. What I do find interesting, and Glenn might be able to speak to as well, is that once this happened, all of those questions went away. Nobody really followed up on it, and nobody found out who Lucy Ramirez was, this woman who supposedly gave the documents to Bill Burkett. The trail is very, very cold in terms of that.
Glenn, what are your thoughts about who was behind this?
Well, I think first the facts. I think that CBS, that Mary and Dan had actually given this packet of documents that included the ones we're talking about to the White House. And I think the White House just tried to find the fastest, quickest one to use to counter the story. It is very, very true that they moved so fast. I was in D.C. In fact, went on Scarborough, who was on at night at that time, mm-hmm. and I was just getting ready to go on Scarborough when I started to get calls. I don't even think that the Wednesday 60 Minutes 2 was over with when I started getting calls from people helping me at the time, telling me to be prepared for questions about those documents, which I knew nothing about. So they happened really fast. That part about it is true. And I think the caller has an interesting point that they would, whoever, if it was a setup, if it was a trap, as he said, boy, it required a kind of almost mind-reading sophistication to know exactly what was in Killian's mind at that time, which his secretary later confirmed over and over. That itself is kind of would be a remarkable feat, even for an intelligence agency. I've never really bought the conspiracy theory part of it. I think it was just normal political, hey, here's a weak point, let's attack it and see what happens. And that's what the White House did. I do want to say, not to the credit of American journalism at the time, the rapidity with which the rest of the press sort of turned on Rather in 60 Minutes and dropped all pursuit of the George Bush story, all right, it doesn't speak well of journalism at the time, regardless of the outcome of the matter at CBS.
Boston Globe reporter Walter Robinson, again, he's the reporter who wrote about the one-year gap in Bush's guard duty for the Boston Globe on May 23, 2000. He said, quote, the CBS story and the furor that it caused buried the story so deeply, inevitably the only candidate who ended up with a serious credibility problem about his military service was John Kerry, who had nothing to hide or be ashamed of. To me, writes Walter Robinson, in a close election, and it was a close election, who knows, that could have been the difference. And I can't play. We do have a clip of Marion Carr Knox, who's Colonel Jerry Killian's secretary. She went on 60 Minutes in 2004, but it's really staticky because, again, that was like right in the beginning when the internet was first, you know, beginning. And so it's just too much static. But in that interview with Dan Rather, she says, I did not type those memos. Those words belong in the Army, not the National Guard. But the information in those memos is correct. I did type other memos containing the same information. And we'll put that clip at yourcallradio.org. Glenn, what about that?
Well, it's like other elements of the story, isn't it? And by the way, as we talk on and on about this, I know that James is going to be a little more humble than he should be. This film is a remarkable piece of Americana, and it should be seen as much for its quality and the questions it raises and the subtlety with which it's presented as the controversy over Bush. Now, that said, that's another one of those facts that just doesn't make it into sort of the folkloric political beliefs about the incident now. They just think that the documents were forged, and they fail to go back and remember that Killian's secretary said, well, that's what was in his mind at the time.
Well, and it's getting pretty much slammed in the media. What are your thoughts on that, Glenn?
Fascinating thing. Not to wax too, you know, to get too far away from the film itself, but if you'll notice, the detractors have to do something the film doesn't do. They have to make it a melodrama. They have to make it far more about villains and heroes in black and white than the film actually presents the characters in this movie. And then, of course, the heroes are on their side and the villains are on the other side. But that doesn't, they're reviewing and commenting on a movie that doesn't exist in order to make a political point. It's also written unusual in politics, by the way. It happens almost daily.
Yes.
It's happening today with Hillary Clinton at the Benghazi hearings. It's just fascinating to watch. Actually, I think the film reviewers have been far more honest, obviously, than the political class has in reacting to the film. But they have to turn it into something it isn't in order to justify their criticism.
James?
Well, I think also the politics, I think you know, it's there's an irony to it, because the film says a lot about how, you know, when people don't like what a story is about, that they start screaming and pointing and causing a furor and shouting as loud as they can to sort of drown out what the initial question is. And that's something that seems to be happening a little bit with the film. The film is built so that you can see it and make up your own mind in terms of what do you think has happened or not. And I think what's fascinating to me as a filmmaker is watching audiences come out of it, and you'll have husbands and wives, you know, and the husband or wife will say, you know, I think they should have been fired. And the other one will say, I can't believe you would say that. What are you talking about? And a real conversation comes out of it. And that's what I think is wonderful about it. And I think it's a wonderful, and it's an emotional story too about Mary as well. So as much as we're talking about what happened back then and going back through it, you know, the film is not built to re-prosecute it. The film is built to take you on this journey of what these people went through in an incredibly interesting and difficult time in our country's history.
James Vanderbilt is director of the film Truth. It opens tomorrow. And Glenn Smith is author of The Politics of Deceit, Saving Freedom and Democracy. He's been a reporter in Texas for 30 years. And let's go next to Franz in San Rafael. Hi, Franz. Welcome to the show.
Good morning there. I'm going to take this off speakerphone. Can you still hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, it didn't come off speakerphone, so much for the button. I'm founding member number 43 and the original captain of the guard for the California Vietnam Veterans Memorial Watch Association. I am a Vietnam era United States Navy veteran, honorably discharged 1975. And I was involved with a little bit of something along the same lines of this with a Republican politician by the name of John Doolittle here in California. At the time, he was out of Roseville. Later on, he moved up to the Lake Tahoe area. Essentially, his service came up because he had claimed he had been ordered by his church, the Mormon Church elders, to go to Brazil, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, for missionary work. I followed up the story myself because I'm a little bit of an ankle biter. That's actually one of the duties was political liaison as my captain of the guard duties, besides giving honors, burial honors to deceased veterans, which we were more than happy to do. We were requested to do that by the older veterans, World War II. It was actually a surprise, considering the fact that Vietnam veterans didn't exactly get a warm welcome back in a lot of cases. I actually had 14 fellows jump out of a van in San Diego and attack two other crew members and myself with 2x4s, pieces of rebar, lengths of chain. Anyway, back to John Doolittle. I followed up on that story. I attempted to contact the eldest member of the Mormon Church. Unfortunately, at that time...
Fans, we're almost out of time, and I want to make sure our guests can respond.
All right.
Can you wrap it up? I mean, your main point is that California Republican Senator John Doolittle
had lied about his being required by the elders of the Mormon Church. He had actually had a lot of pressure put on them because I did get in touch with the second in charge elder of the Mormon Church, and I quote, he said John Doolittle was a damn liar.
Well, thank you for calling in, Fans. Glenn, this raises questions just about journalism. And again, once the 60 Minutes piece ran in 2004, it was all about the documents, not the arguments behind it. And there could have been some really great stories about what Fans just brought up, who got preferential treatment back then and who didn't. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think it'd be interesting in 10 years from now, somebody's going to make a really good movie about the making of this movie. I mean, I think it raises that many poignant and interesting questions. But in any case, there have been a lot written over the years about the issues of class and privilege and who went to Vietnam and who didn't go to Vietnam.
Right.
And, And, you know, depending on what side of the political aisle you fall on, you have different attitudes about it. It's unquestionable that it happened at the time. And but that also should obscure something else, that what I when I was investigating all of this, for the most part, the most outraged parties were the honorable men and women who had served in the military since that time and during that time.
Yes.
You know, and I had several of them approach me without a political axe to grind, but they had fulfilled their service. They had lost friends in service, and they felt that the honor of the American military was somewhat besmirched. They wanted to speak out about it in kind of non-political terms. In other words, I thought it spoke very well for the American military organization as I spoke to them during the time of my investigation.
James, have you had any reaction from the National Guard or people who served in Vietnam?
I haven't had an official reaction. I have spoken to people who served who, you know, they feel the same way as sort of Glenn said, is, you know, if you know, this is still an open wound, I think, for our country. And, you know, who had to go and who didn't. And if you didn't go, somebody went in your place. And that someone may not have come back. So I think that, you know, Mary and Dan felt that this was an important story to investigate. It was, you know, these are questions that should be asked. And that's why they did it. And, you know, they walked in. And they weren't, as it's been pointed out, they weren't the only ones asking this question. There were a lot of different people who were onto the story, and they were competing with, you know, and that's, you know, journalism, is mm-hmm. you compete with other people. And, you know, Mary and Dan got there first and broke the story and, you know, basically ran into a propeller. And when you see somebody run into a propeller, you're less likely to go down that same corridor. And so the story got dropped. But I think that's what's, you know, that's what's so interesting about the film. And that's why I think people should see the film. And the fact that it's touching this nerve again, and the fact that, you know, CBS doesn't want to run ads for it, I encourage people to go and see what all the fuss is about.
Glenn, final thoughts. As someone who's been reporting for 30 years in Texas, this just raises so many questions about the state of investigative journalism. What are your thoughts as you kind of reflect back on your career and where we are today?
Well, I was talking to some of my former colleagues in the press the other day about it, and remarkable, it was kind of Woodward and Bernstein that got me interested in journalism at the time and why I wound up going into it. I had times when sources on stories retracted what they told me. It seemed almost got me in trouble, but I never had an editor or a publisher not back me up. And most of my colleagues here and elsewhere around the country would say the same thing. The Washington Post support of Woodward and Bernstein was back in the day far more regular, and I'm afraid now that one of the problems is with the expanded corporate ownership of mainstream media, and I don't put a black hat on corporations, but one of the things that's happened is the owners are far distant from their own reporters.
Well, we're out of time, but we'd love to have you back to continue this conversation about investigative journalism. Glenn Smith has been a reporter in Texas for 30 years, author of The Politics of Deceit, and James Vanderbilt is director of the film Truth. It opens tomorrow. Check out yourcallradio.org for more information and links. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Ashley Ann Krigbaum is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.